Welcome to the podcast.ua with Tinka
and Vadim. This podcast is dedicated to Ukrainian studies.
We conduct interviews with scholars from the UNDIPUS project,
which stands for Undisciplined Pluralizing Ukrainian Studies, Understanding the War in Ukraine.
Join us on the .ua podcast.
And today we have junior professor Roman Dubasevich as our guest. Welcome, Roman.
Thank you, Vadim.
Roman works at this university and he is an essential part of the UNDIPUS project. Roman Dubasevich is engaged in cultural studies, and the main theme of his research is Ukraine, its past and present. I think today's interview will be very interesting. Roman, thank you for agreeing to be interviewed for .ua. Firstly, I would like to ask you to tell more about yourself, your academic path, and what you are currently working on.
Thank you, Vadim, for the invitation. I started my academic career in German studies in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. It's very close to the Polish border and now quite known as a hub, an important hub to Ukraine. And already during my studies, I had the opportunity to travel abroad, to study abroad, and I continued my studies at Freiburg University and in Austria, at the University of Graz. And afterwards, I decided to resettle to the West and to continue my education. And it was very interesting that studying German studies in the West, I realized that the interest for the Eastern Europe and Ukraine was so great that it was quite challenging to fill this gap and to explain Ukraine, the post-Soviet space, to my German, Austrian, or Western colleagues. So while doing my second degree at Regensburg University, I was slowly reorientating myself from German studies to Slavic studies. At the University of Regensburg, my degree had two directions, one political philosophy, another one theory of literature. So I started to work on Ukrainian literature. At that time, very few people were doing it as a main subject. And afterwards, after working as a tourist guide and translator, interpreter, also teacher at Ivan Franko University Lviv, I came to a conclusion to continue my academic career and went to Austria, to the University of Vienna, where I participated in the first graduate school in humanities created and funded at Vienna University and funded by Fonds zur Förderung der Wissenschaft, a very famous institution comparable to DFG in Germany. So I did my PhD at Vienna University, and while writing on it, I was already invited to start my career as an academic teacher in the University of Greifswald. So this was in short my academic trajectory. And I started working with postcolonial theory and theories of cultural memory, and since the eruption of the armed conflict in Ukraine and Donbass in 2014, I was slowly deepening my research in the area of studies of heroism and masculinity. And this is something which occupies me till now. So the understanding of the dynamics of escalation, of dynamics of the war, of the prehistory of the war, and its connection to traumatic experiences, representations of trauma in national narratives or national imagination, and of course its connection to gender.
What is the main direction of your work within UNDIPUS, like researching of prehistory of this conflict, these narratives, or something else?
I started with the prehistory of this confrontation, which especially can be traced back to a kind of Kulturkampf, which broke out after the end of the Soviet Union, where Ukrainian elites started started to have they got an initiative in formulating the new national narrative, and they started looking for the next formulas for this meta narrative. One of the formulas was the return to Europe, the symbolic return to Europe, and I was researching how this symbolic return to Europe, which was quite a legitimate enterprise, was connected also to the othering and of other regions of Ukraine. So we have this very strange connection of liberalization, but liberalization also via creating a kind of uncultured, uncivilized, and unliberal post-Soviet other, and this post-Soviet other was basically located in the Russophone regions of Ukraine, regions belonging to the Russian Empire. But as I said previously, I discovered, especially after the outbreak of the war, that through the return and actualization of certain nationalist narratives, and through the traumas produced by war, we were witnessing kind of comeback of heroism, which was banned for many years, starting I think as late as with the war in Afghanistan. The idea of heroism was quite discredited, but we could observe that in this many gaps and deficits of the post-Soviet time, deficits of moral integrity, deficits of reliability, and deficits produced by corruption, very often in Ukraine, narratives, ideas of heroic, uncorruptible resistance, masculine resistance were put. And I was observing this very surprising actualization of certain formulas provoked by the war. And this was the idea I came into Antipus project, because the whole idea of Antipus was just to try to counteract certain tendencies in Ukrainian humanities, especially polarization and the fallback, regress in a kind of heroic, militant narratives of identity.
So you mentioned heroism and nationalist narratives. So how it's working in Ukraine now? How these narratives is dealing with heroism, and whether there are any critique discourse in Ukraine about heroism now?
First of all, it is almost impossible to criticize heroism, because heroism seems to be a necessary condition for survival, guarantee for survival. But as a scholar, you can also imagine, and you know, many situations where certain types of heroism were the opposite of survival, they deepen it, the crisis, they deepen it, the confrontation, and they ignited the spirals of escalation. So if I look at Ukrainian, the contemporary Ukrainian situation, I would say that Ukrainian society lived in a kind of parallel realities. One reality was the everyday troubles, everyday endurances, and all the problems Ukrainians have to resolve. And in this everyday reality, with the corruption at many institutions and hard life conditions, people rarely thought about heroic figures from the past. So if you would speak, for example, about glorification of Stepan Bandera, or Roman Shuchevich, Yaroslav Stitsko, and so on, or the heroes of Holodny Yar, yes? But what is interesting and very logical from the point of view of trauma theory, as soon as we get into the situation of the war, after the annexation of Crimea and after the Russian support for insurgency in Donbass, for Donbass separatists, Ukraine went through a situation of a deep crisis. A deep crisis, and usually deep crisis can provoke also regression to a more primitive functioning mechanisms of models of functioning of society. because heroic models are usually very primitive black and white models. So I could really observe that the Russian attack, the aggression against Ukraine, actualized in a very paradox way narratives which were already there, which were not perhaps that popular, but through the attack, through aggression, they became validated. And so we could observe a kind of comeback and reinstitution in a new, most sacralized way of the figures of this glorified figures of Ukrainian nationalist resistance or nationalist movement like Stepan Bandera, or they even efforts to develop a more lighter model, like, for example, anti-Soviet guerrilla from the 20s. So I could see a kind of re-emergence and rise in popularity of these figures.
Yeah, so you mentioned how these heroic narratives in Ukraine now is linked to a history of anti-Soviet movements in Ukraine. But I think as Ukrainian, of course, I know that like Soviet past or Soviet heroic narratives were big part of Ukrainian history and Ukrainian culture before. How now we can see what's happening with these Soviet narratives in Ukraine? Is it forbidden to use these narratives due to Russian aggression, because Russia is using now in their propaganda these Soviet narratives, Soviet heroic narratives?
Yeah, this is true. Putin sells the attack against Ukraine, the support of separatism, to his public, to his electorate as a fight against fascism. The question seems very, 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 very simple at the first glance. So, of course, since independence, Ukrainian elites try to get rid of Soviet symbolism, and especially over the last 2 years since the Russian aggression, over the traces of Russian culture in Ukraine and in heroic imperial narratives. Like the monuments to Russian commander Suvorov and so on. But if you look deeper, in many in the iconography of Ukrainian heroism, be it Bandera or be it the heroes of Holodny Yar, you see surprisingly the recurring or returning forms of the Soviet heroism. So the glorification of UPA, Ukrainian Insurgent Army, has a lot of, in my eyes, common traits with the glorification of Soviet partisans. So they were common denominators. One of these common denominators of these narratives was, for example, the demand of unconditioned self-sacrifice and for the sake of a bigger cause, of a higher cause. In Soviet time, it was a fight against fascism. And at the moment is fight against Russian aggression, or the Russian fascists, as Ukrainians put it. This is one part of the problem. So paradoxically, fighting iconoclastically the Soviet memorial practices, Ukrainians or Ukrainian elites unwittingly provoke their return, and consolidation and in Ukrainian consciousness, Ukrainian public consciousness. But another question which you touch, which is also very important, what is the fate of the Soviet heritage proper? Yeah? For example, starting with industrial achievements like Dnipro HES, Kakhovskoye Vodoskhovishche, the Kakhovka water reservoir, which was damaged during the war, till certain architectural heritage and perhaps achievements in public health and in other areas of life, yes. If you look at this, the situation is much more paradox and much more interesting, because on the one hand, of course, we experience this wave of cancel everything which is Russian is Soviet, and we have this renaming of metro station in Kiev, one of the most iconic examples, or the removal, even destruction of the Soviet war memorials in Lviv and at other places where the Soviet monuments are removed. But on the other hand, when it fits the public or the political the political purpose, we can see even a certain pride articulated in this in the achievements. For example, Ukrainians are very proud of the flexibility, adaptability, especially in terms of improvisation with war armament and war equipment and arms. And we know that this ingenuity of constructing new weapons and modifying drones and improvising things is very much connected to the polytechnical heritage, if to put it short, of the Soviet period. But with the achievement of natural sciences, Ukraine also had its share in. This is one, certainly one part. But in other parts of the Soviet past, for example, as I said, the memorial culture are immediately cancelled and forgotten. So we have a very contradictory picture, and nothing exemplifies better this this paradox as the movie produced, I think, like 10 years ago, Teuschung Prischung Kriegsverhorn I Wodu.
So, so-called decommunization or desovietization was a big part of official politics in Ukraine from 2014. But with full-scale invasion, we are witnessing now de-Russification politics in Ukraine, and we see that it's within Ukrainian society, it's much more debatable topic, because there are a lot of Russophone population in Ukraine, there are a lot of people speaking Russian, there are a lot of people big fans of Russian culture, and so on and so on. It's a big part of history of some parts of Ukraine. So what do you think about it, like now, how this policy is going on now, and whether it's successful and or whether it's not?
I must admit it is not my primary research topic, but anyhow, I think this policy is very tragic and only deepening the wounds and deepening the abyss, not only between the aggressor and the victim, and putting more fuel to the escalation, to the machine of escalation, but it also threatens to implode Ukraine from within, or to split Ukraine from within, because as you already mentioned, we still have a considerable part of Russophone population, and the regions hit mostly by the war are the Russophone regions. And But one of the, actually, I could go back here to Maidan, to Euromaidan uprising. If you remember, one of the most attractive feature about Maidan, Euromaidan movement, were its slogans of inclusivity. Not only Ukrainophone voices were welcome, but there were great efforts taken to create more inclusive idea of civil Ukrainian identity in contrast to kind of ethnocentric Ukrainian identity. But unfortunately, this is perhaps the connection also to the previous topic, due to this test and stress test and crisis Ukraine is undergoing under the aggression, the mechanisms of regression to more simplistic model of thinking, of acting in politically seem to prevail, and that means that everything connected with aggressor, even on a very superficial way, for example via language via a literary canon, was also regarded as toxic, as extremely dangerous for the survival of Ukraine identity. And we could observe a whole wave of measures aiming at de-Russification. It is not called, at least at the beginning, it was not called de-Russification. It was summed up under umbrella of decolonization. So we are decolonizing ourselves, and it is presumed that destroying Pushkin monuments, removing Tolstoy's street names or Chekhov's street names from Ukrainian urban landscape, not only in urban landscape, also in villages. So Ukraine is progressing towards more independence, sovereignty, and so on. And this is quite a dangerous trend, especially because these tendencies are also extended even to the soldiers fighting. Fighting in the Eastern Front, and these politics and these measures have a clearly discriminatory effect. And it was very I felt very ashamed as Ukrainian. I felt very ashamed observing how certain activists like Irina Farion, right-wing activists, and other were outraged about the Russian language in the trenches, which is ubiquitous, all present there due to the fact that we have so many Russophone soldiers. And I was also very ashamed reading some comments on Facebook where people from a home city of Lviv were complaining, hiding in the bunkers from the Russian rockets. They were complaining about the Russophone refugees also hiding in the same bunker. I think these are very very disturbing signs, and the absolute opposite of the healthy national consolidation, which is often proclaimed. I think they rather a sign of a huge tension within Ukrainian society, tension which can threaten its coherence and its emancipatory project.
One can say against this critique that, for example, look at Volodymyr Zelensky. He's a Russophone Ukrainian, and he started to speak Ukrainian, and he actually supported this politics of so-called diversification. And for example, and another on other hand, for example, if we are talking about this heroic agenda, masculinity, we can look at Zelensky as example, like how he switched from I must say very like peaceful kind of politic, I'm talking about his image that was before this full scale invasion. So maybe you can say more about Volodymyr Zelensky and how his image changed, how from your critical point of view, from your studies of masculinity and heroic narratives and all this conflict between cultures, Russian and Ukrainian, Russophone and so on.
Yeah, thank you for this example. Indeed, Zelensky is perhaps the most famous figure in this trend, or the showcase of this tendency, the overlapping of both tendencies, a kind of Kulturkampf, the cultural fight of a clash of civilization on the one hand, and on the other hand, the overlapping with certain models of masculinity, of citizenship, and so on. And if you remember, these were exactly the two critical points articulated against him before his election to the president of Ukraine. First critical point, which also was connected to this old discourse of decolonization, is that he is Little Russian. He's not Ukrainian proper. He's not able to lead the nation. Yes. Because he's Russophone, Ukrainian Jewish descent. On the other hand, because he is a comedian, yeah, yes, a successful entrepreneur in show business, but not an experienced politician like Petro Poroshenko or others. And you can see how Zelensky, being actually at the beginning perhaps an example of the positive populism or positive populist, was how his populism was changing under the public pressures, under the demands articulated by the society, Ukrainian society is. And these demands were the Ukraine phone presidents, being the guarantee that Ukraine will never come back into the realm of Russian influence or Russian imperialism, and on the other hand, the leader of the nation. And you could see how this image of being a comedian and being the second-rate Ukrainian slowly has changed and coalesced in the sphere of heroic resistant leader of a resistant undefeated unbroken nation. Yes, and part of this unbrokenness is of course connected to a certain model of Ukraine identity and the dominant element or hegemonic element in this model at the moment is of course this Ukrainocentric core. It should be Ukrainocentric is the core, otherwise it is too easily corrupted by Russian influence. This is the idea behind it.
Having worked for a long time in Germany and dealing with Ukrainian studies, how do you assess the state of Ukrainian studies in Germany? Have there been any changes in Ukrainian studies here and worldwide? And how do you evaluate these changes?
I think that Ukrainian studies has received at the moment a huge impulse, which they can use for further development, development of institutions, of communication, of networking. Thousands of Ukrainian scholars moved or fled to the West from the war, and many of them would never have a chance to work within Western institutions. And it is a huge chance for Ukrainian academic culture, for Ukrainian academic tradition in general. And of course, this is perhaps the positive moment in this general tragedy of the war and destruction. But at the same time, the situation also contains its dangers, because the war creates a lot of pressures on society. We already spoke about them. And one of the pressures is to de-Russify, to decolonize Ukrainian society from its common Russian-Ukrainian past or imperial past. And another tendency is also the polarization of discourse. And so the academic disciplines feel themselves increasingly as advocates or even defenders of Ukrainian identity, advocates of Ukrainian political agenda abroad. And this is a very difficult balance, because of course we should promote truthful information about Ukraine, trying to defy Russian propaganda and fake news. This is very important, but it is not important defending the values of freedom of thought, freedom of press, not themselves being got into the trappings of instrumentalization of mobilization. So my observation was that very often many of my colleagues have become more advocates and propagandists, fighting Russian fake news, fighting Russian propaganda, and losing the critical ability or critical values and agenda so pertinent and important to the disciplines of history, for example, or of cultural studies, and this seemed to be a very central challenge to Ukrainian studies in general. In which direction they will develop? Will they open, and will they establish global critical standards and reach up to these critical standards, or they will encapsulate themselves in this anti-propaganda warfare and encapsulate themselves in isolationist and isolationist tendencies. So, and of course, this is a difficult question, ethical question, how to balance between all these extremes. But I think the grand challenge would be just not themselves fighting the Russian propaganda, not themselves being turned into the tool of propaganda.
Yeah, anti-propaganda could be propaganda too, actually. So that's a big problem. Do you personally feel any pressure from academic community, society, Ukrainian or German, when addressing such challenging questions, when you're working in such critical discourse in your studies, especially during the war?
In a way, Andipos, my initiative to create Andipos, to create a group of scholars who are dissatisfied with the state of affairs, who see the danger, was an effort to anticipate this development, because this development was partly already visible in 2014 after the trauma of Euromaidan massacre and annexation of Crimea and so on. But of course, since the outbreak of the war, since Russian attack and full-scale invasion, the situation deteriorated, so it has become most impossible to exercise this critical mission or critical agency we have to develop and nurture in our disciplines. For instance, how to criticize the Ukrainian memorial culture glorifying Stepan Bandera when Stepan Bandera was rediscovered as a symbol of unbroken, undefeatable Ukrainian resistance. So it has become impossible to criticize him, but nevertheless he was leader of Ukrainian fascism. And the next step, which is even more critical, is even if Ukrainian political establishment is quite disillusioned about the past, and for example Volodymyr Zelensky together with Andrzej Duda were visiting the places of massacres by OPA in Berlin and Polish Catholic churches. At the same time, the greatest challenge is to connect, for example, the certain practices, memorial practices, historical heroic narratives to the origins of the war, to see that a part of Putin's contribution to this war, perhaps certain practices could, on the Ukrainian side, could also prepare the ground for confrontation, increasing Russian paranoia and delivering Putin very rational-looking arguments for persuasion and to persuade his public, Russian public, that Ukraine is developing into a fascist state we have to fight. So I think the two challenges, one just in terms of memory politics in a strict sense, in another challenge to see the connection between memory politics and contemporary political and military disaster.
Roman, thank you for this interesting conversation and your important work. I hope this is not the last time we're talking.
Yeah, thank you Adam, for invitation and for listening.
We spoke with Roman Dobosevich, a junior professor at the University of Greifswald. Goodbye. It was the podcast Punkt.ua,
which is part of the Unipus project at the University of Greifswald,
with Vadim
and Tinka,
supported by the German Federal Ministry of Education and Research.
Join us on the Punkt.ua podcast.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.